family affiliation. And it was after that that God said, okay, Levi is devoted to me. You know, I'm going to give them basically to the service of the temple, the tabernacle, then the temple. So we see that reference here. And they were to be teachers of God's law. Levi, like Simeon, was to be scattered through Israel. That's one thing Jacob prophesied. Remember, they were instruments of cruelty, he said, after the incident with Dinah, when they had this negotiation and they tricked the men of Shechem, I think, to all be circumcised. Then Levi and Simeon went in and killed all the men. So, Jacob described them as such. And Levi, well, they were to be scattered. Many of them ended up in the southern nation of Judah and through the ages became known as Jews, even though, the idea is they might be called Jewish, but they're probably actually Levites. Does that make sense? Same would hold true for Benjamin, which is where we're going. In verse 12, of Benjamin he said, the beloved of the Lord shall dwell safely by him. Who shelters him all the day long, he shall dwell between his shoulders. As I said, Benjamin's territory was within the nation of Judah, and it was to the north. According to the way some people draw the maps, Benjamin's territory even included Mount Moriah, which as Jerusalem expanded, Jerusalem came to include Mount Moriah, and that's where the temple was built. And part of the reason I'm mentioning this is some say that people have used the poetic phrase and looked at Mount Zion, which was also in Jerusalem, and Mount Moriah, and referred to those as the shoulders of God. And so that might be a reference here to Benjamin, who dwells, he shall dwell between his shoulders. Some say it's a poetic reference to those mountains. Others that it's just, sort of a mark of God's protection. As I said, many Benjamites probably are known as Jews today because of being in the kingdom of Judah. But some people have said that Benjamin might be the majority of the modern nation of Norway. And I've heard some speculation about Scotland also. So obviously there's not a wide consensus. Picking up in verse 13, you deal with Joseph, which remember, Joseph was divided into the two sub-tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, blessed is the Eternal in his land with the precious things of the heaven and of the dew and of the deep lying beneath, the precious fruits of the sun, precious produce of the months, the best things of the ancient mountains, precious things of the everlasting hills. Say, the descendants of Joseph get it pretty good. And the rich blessings on Joseph could refer to the fact that in ancient times, in Israel, they got some pretty good land. You remember, they got... Map is getting... Half of Manasseh got this rich prairie land, but the rest of Manasseh is over in here. I'm trying to remember. They're sort of in the middle. Ephraim is just above Benjamin. So they got some good land in ancient Israel. But if our understanding is correct, and I believe Mr. McNeely is going to move on to the next doctrine of the promises to Abraham, that Jacob, when he adopted Ephraim and Manasseh, had his name named on them, we look for the fulfillment of God's promises to be especially bestowed on the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh, which we believe are represented today as what we call the English-speaking peoples. Rich and powerful, whether deserving it or not. In many cases, there are a lot of times when we haven't deserved it, but we've enjoyed those blessings. You see that phrase, horns, is in there, and I've got it marked in my notes and not in here. Well, actually, in verse 17, his glory is like a firstborn bull, and his horns like the horns of an ox. Together with him, he'll push the people. It's not saying that the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh will grow horns any more than Moses had horns when he came down from Mount Sinai, but it's a symbol of military power. It was in ancient times, and obviously referring to, Britain and the United States having great military power, even in modern times. Actually, I've been reading recently about the Hundred Years' War, and I knew this, but I was reminded of how powerful England, when they innovated the longbow, they conquered most of France, and there was a time when they were militarily supreme back in the 1300s, which kind of impressive. I think of them rising to their greatest power in the 1800s, which they did, but you know, they've been up and down for a long time. I'm dragging. Let's move on. Verses 18 and 19 will lump Zebulun and Issachar both together. You know, of Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar in your tents. They'll call the peoples of the holy mountain and offer sacrifices of righteousness. Partake of the abundance of the seas and the treasures hidden in the sand." We believe Zebulun was prosperous from trading and had access to the sea. And looking for their modern descendants, some people believe that their descendants are now found in the Netherlands, which many people just say Holland, but they also have been wealthy because of trade by the sea. Issachar was prosperous in agriculture, and some people think where it says treasures hidden in the sand, their speculation of ancient times, some say that they had access to some sands at the sea there that were very good for making high-quality glass, which is something you don't hear every day. Others say, no, it's referring to a type of shellfish from which you could derive the expensive purple dye. You know, purple dye like Lydia in the book of Acts, you know, made and sold apparently. So we're not sure, but it seems that they were doing pretty well. Move on, verse 20. Of Gad, he said, "Blessed is he who enlarges Gad. He dwells as a lion and tears the arm and the crown of the head, provided the first part for himself because a lawgiver's portion was reserved there, came with the heads of the people and ministered the justice of the Eternal and his judgments with Israel." I'm pretty sure this is considerably more about Gad than Jacob had to say back in Genesis. Gad inherited their land, the promised land, first, because, remember, they took a portion on this side of the river, okay? So they were among the first to get their inheritance. That seems to be a reference partly to this. Even though we know the Gadites did send soldiers to conquer the Canaanites and help the rest of the tribes obtain, you know, their land. It's worth making a reference to a scripture in 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles 12 and verse 8. Describes the Gadites as mighty men of valor trained for battle. It said they had faces like lions and they were swift. So I don't know if that applied to the tribe of Gad for a long time, but apparently they were formidable warriors. You don't want to have to fight Gad, which seems like you got to come up with another name. Gad just sounds funny. But I won't make bad jokes. Verse 20, I want to go on from there. Yeah, verse 22, Dan is a lion's whelp. He'll leap from Bashan. This parallels Genesis 49, verses 16 through 18. There in Genesis 49, Dan is compared to a serpent. Now he's compared to a lion's whelp. This seems to imply aggressiveness and conquest. And if you remember from the book of Judges, after they had initially got their inheritance, Dan had some space down here and they said, "This is enough land for us." You know, and so Joshua said, "Well, go conquer some more." And they also went up here and wiped out that village, and some of them moved up there. So Dan was aggressive and didn't conquer. I've got a note here. Some people speculate that the modern descendants of Dan can be found in Denmark, and others say Ireland or both. And I'm overlooked. As far as the modern descendants of Gad, we don't know. The speculation's just all over the place. There's not one place that most people have said, "Oh, that seems to be right." So we go to verse 23. Let's talk about Naphtali, or some say Naphtali. Naphtali, satisfied with favor and full of the blessings of the Lord, possessed the west and the south. Doesn't tell us much about Naphtali. Expect good blessings. And doesn't say much bad. And some people believe that the modern descendants of Naphtali can be found in Sweden. And that this kind of blessing would fit them. People in Sweden have had pretty good stuff, not much bad. Of course, you could say find other peoples you could say that about. In verse 24, we start speaking of Asher. "Asher is most blessed of sons. Let him be favored by his brothers. Let him dip his foot in oil, and your sandals will be of iron and bronze. As your days, so shall your strength be." This seems to indicate that Asher will inherit some very fertile land. And in Palestine, you know, in ancient times, they did get some good land. And I'm just waving here because often I don't remember and I forget. When I'm sitting back there, I say, man, that map is small. They can't see anything. So just pretend I'm a weatherman doing this, you know, in front of a green screen. But Asher got some good land. And the modern descendants of Asher are believed to have located in Belgium and northern France, which is also very good land. Historically, that area of Europe has been very good farmland. Now, if you wonder, sticking your foot in oil might sound kind of weird. It's not something I've ever wanted to do. It seems to be referring to pressing olives for olive oil. So it's not some weird thing of sticking your foot in oil, especially if it were motor oil, but referring to, again, the riches of agriculture and oil from olives. The sandals being of iron and or bronze, there's a couple ways of looking at that. Some people think it might be referring to military preparedness, like heavy boots. But others say, no, it's referring to agricultural living, dressing ruggedly for being outdoors. And I'm not sure if there's a strong reason we should argue for either interpretation. And then Moses will summarize. He's covered the tribes. So he begins, you know, praising God. There's no one like the God of Jeshurun who rides the heaven to help you in his excellency. The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are his everlasting arms. He'll thrust out the enemy before you. Israel will dwell in safety. Verse 29, happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the eternal. And I'm making the point that after Moses mentions some specific blessings for the various tribes, he comes back and says, the greatest blessing of all is having God, the true God. That's better than any of that. God is your greatest blessing. He'll bring you great happiness. And I like the phrase, underneath are everlasting arms, because arms are a symbol of strength oftentimes in Bible poetry. But this also might be an indication of God being there ready to catch you when you fall. I mean, if you've ever had, you know, well, I know I've done, I remember doing this with Connor in the swimming pool, and some people have. He's standing on the edge, and you're like, come on, jump, I'll catch you. You know, and you don't want to be doing that where they're up in a tree and can't get down and you have to catch them, but still, you'd want somebody with strong arms there to catch you when you're in trouble. And it seems that God is making this promise for Israel. It's like you have that blessing. You've got somebody there to catch you when you fall. And that concludes Moses' blessings. And we go into chapter 34. And one of the things I would mention, unless God specifically inspired Moses to write this in advance, then it might well likely have been written by someone else, since, you know, he couldn't say, well, three in the afternoon yesterday I died, but I had to wake up and write this and then go die again. So there's some speculation. I could see where God might have said, Moses, write it like this. And Moses, oh, this isn't very inspiring. Some people say Joshua might have written it, and it makes a good prelude into the book of Joshua, which we think Joshua wrote. It's worth noting that the last three verses I'll cover, some people think that the last three verses were written much later, and a lot of people think possibly by Ezra when he was putting the Old Testament together. So anyways, knowing this, you know, then it's verse 34, it says, Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah. So Pisgah, you know, some people believe is the name of the mountain range. Remember, he's still east of the Jordan. And that Nebo then is the specific point. Did I say that backwards? No, like Pisgah might have been the mountain range, but the peak that he went on to is Nebo. And that would explain why different names you have at different times. And it says he saw, you know, yeah, he went to the top of Pisgah, across Jericho, and the Eternal showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan. So Gilead is going back this way and up. So he showed him all that, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the south, the plain, the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. And you get the feeling God is there with him. It's not just Moses alone on a peak looking around. It says God showed him and God spoke to him. The Lord said to him, "This is the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, 'I'll give it to your descendants.'" For Moses, you know, he's heard about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob all his life. They're his ancestors. But remember how far removed it is. It would be if you had a descendant maybe who came over to America on the Mayflower and someone had said, "Hey, this was an arrangement made with, you know, Joe Smith or whatever who was on the Mayflower. Now it's being fulfilled in you." It's that kind of distance. But Moses knew his history, his family history. So God shows him this. Now, there's discussion, you know, did God miraculously cause Moses to see things that wouldn't have been possible? And I've heard many people speculate that, and I've sort of thought that's likely. But I've heard some people say that if you get up at high enough on a clear day, you can see a lot of that area. And I don't know, maybe that's possible, and maybe God could have made sure that the weather was just right that day. But I don't think it's a stretch, considering all the miracles God had done, that, you know, God might have given Moses supervision, or he toted up a screen in the projector and showed it to him, speaking facetiously. But so God, you know, did for Moses, he wanted to make sure he saw the blessing. Moses was 120 years old. Maybe he would, you know, maybe God had miraculously kept him alive that long anyways. So we don't want to think that God is prematurely ending Moses' life as a punishment. I think it's rather he used him and now it's the next stage. And Moses will get to see the promised land and go wherever he wants in the resurrection. But if we go into verse 5, well, God says, "You'll see it, but you won't go over." So Moses, the servant of the Eternal, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Eternal. So just like God said, and he buried him. Notice that he is capitalized. Moses didn't bury himself. God buried him in a valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. No one knows his grave to this day. I mean, what a mark of honor to have God come down. For some reason, I imagine God with a shovel on his shoulder coming down and digging a grave. I mean, he could have sent an angel to do it, but God did it personally. You know, whether it's the way I might envision or not, but God had that kind of relationship with Moses. Like, no, I don't want someone else doing this. I'm going to do it. Now, this question over why he would hide his grave, Nate? Okay, yeah, it's in Jude verse 9. There is where it says, Michael contended with Satan over the body of Moses. And then we say, well, what in the world would Satan want with his body? And it doesn't tell us, but there's speculation that, you know, as revered as Moses was, if Satan could have got his body, he could have made an idol out of it. And the children of Israel were prone to go worshiping idols. So God made sure that couldn't happen. Not only the body wasn't available, but they didn't know where the grave was. They couldn't build a shrine. They couldn't come and visit it and leave teddy bears and candles on it and things like that. You know, it's just go by the reputation. Go by what's written here. The word about Moses is what's important, not where his body is. But no, I mentioned that God might have blessed and preserved Moses' health. It's interesting, in verse 7, he was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor diminished. So he didn't need these. He could see fine, which is good. I don't know if these were invented yet. And his vigor wasn't diminished. This seems that the underlying or main meaning seems to be that he kept his strength and his well-being. He could go do things. A literal translation is that his moisture was not dried. So it wasn't all dried up. I'll mention this, and I don't mean to be vulgar, but there are some Jewish traditions mean that particular phrase in Hebrew meant he could still perform sexually, which 120-year-old guy, let's give him credit if that's true. Okay, so Moses, but God withdrew the blessings or whatever, and Moses ended his life. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days until they were ended. 30 days seems to have been the mourning period for someone of especially high rank. A common person would have normally been 7 days. So Moses gets the highest accord of honor. And then we see verse 9, now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom. Why? Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him, did as the Eternal had commanded Moses. So Joshua, remember, was chosen by God, but Moses had inaugurated him. Moses laid hands on him, made for a smooth succession. There wasn't a fight for power after Moses died. I'm in charge. No, I'm in charge. God, through Moses, made sure everybody knew, and it was clear and easy. Some nations are getting better. In the church, we've gotten better at that than we used to. And something we all would strive for, something we'd all want. But as good as Joshua did, and I mentioned at the end of Joshua, it says the people obeyed all of his days and the elders who outlived him. But it says in verse 10, since then there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. That's something. God talked to Moses, probably, if not on a daily basis, close to it. And Moses, verse 11, said, worked signs and wonders which the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt before Pharaoh and all his servants in the land by all the mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. Now, I will remind you that back in Deuteronomy 18, verse 15, Moses had prophesied that there would be a prophet like me. And in Acts 3, 22, Peter said that was a prophecy of Christ. And I've discussed it a couple of times how, okay, I think it was both a prophecy of Christ, but also an indication of how God would communicate, not speaking the Ten Commandments from the top of a mountain, but sending a messenger. The fact that it talks about since then, there hasn't been a prophet, that's why it doesn't seem it was written by Joshua. Because if we say, oh, Moses died last week, and since then there has not arisen such a great prophet, you'd think there'd be a time lag. Ezra writing several hundred years later would provide that, if he wrote a little appendage as inspired by God at the end, but that is speculation. There's not a footnote that says, hey, I'm Ezra and I wrote this, so we're not sure. God could have inspired it to be written by Joshua, knowing that he wasn't going to work with anyone quite the same way as with Moses. One thing I got to say is, when I reach this, I think, man, we've been with Moses or Moses' writing all year. We start with Genesis, and I talk about how we believe Moses wrote this. Moses had this special relationship with God. It's always a little sad when we get to this point. I feel like, oh, I'm going to miss him. Of course, he's still in here, but it reminds me, it always brings to mind, my senior year in Ambassador, I was reading a biography of Abraham Lincoln written by Carl Sandburg, the great poet. And it's one of the best biographies of Lincoln ever, and it's like this thick, the abridged version. If you ever get a chance, I urge you to read it. But I remember it was in the spring. I'd been reading it for like 2 months because it's a long book and there's not much time. And I got to the end, and I cried. And I knew he was going to be assassinated by John Wilkes Booth. It's not like it took me by surprise, but it's kind of this way when we get to the end of Moses' life and all that he did, and it's like, oh, it's sad. But I'm looking forward to meeting him in the resurrection. He's one of those people, it's like, oh, I feel like I've gotten to know him since teaching this class in a way I didn't appreciate before. So I hope I'm trying to share some of that with you, hopes that you'll appreciate Moses and the work he did. And you might appreciate him more when you don't have to take a test on the book. Okay, so let's call it a day, and I'll see you all here tomorrow.